This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Tanu Rabbonin, a rabbi's land, en ma'avrim et hashono elo b'mezumonin lo. The year would only be declared a leap year by a gathering of chachomim who were invited for that specific purpose. But each person, each chacham at the gathering which was going to declare the year Me'ubar, a leap year, each member of that gathering had to be there by a special appointment. Ma'aseh, there was a case. Rabban Gamliel she'omar hashkimu li shivo la'aliyah. Rabban Gamliel said, I want 7 people to get up early tomorrow morning and to come to my study for the purpose of Kiddush HaChodesh. Hishkim, he got up early. Umotzo shmoine, and he found 8. With us it works the other way around. When Bernard says he needs 6 people to help him clean the base of Medrash, he comes in the morning and there are only 5. But with Rabban Gamliel, when he wanted 7, he came in and he found that there were 8. That means there's somebody there who isn't supposed to be there, and his presence would or could invalidate the declaration of the leap year. Omar, so he got up and he said, Mihu she'olo she'loi birushus yered. Whoever it is who has come up here without permission should go down, he should go away. Omad Shmuel HaKotun, Shmuel HaKotun got up, the Omar, and he said, Anihu she'alisi she'loi birushus. I'm terribly sorry, I'm the one who came here without invitation. V'loi la'aber hashomer olisi, and I didn't come here to participate in the deliberations. The purpose of locking the door is that we don't open it. And I came here not for the purposes of being ma'abe of the year, elo lilmud halochel lemaase hutzrachti. I came here as a student to watch and to study and to see how it's done. I've come to learn. I haven't come to participate. I've come to learn. Omar lo, Rabban Gamliel said to him, Shev b'ni shev. Please sit down, don't go away. Ru'uyes kol ha'shonim kulom li'is'aber al yodcho. All the years should be so lucky as to be declared mu'uberes by such as yourself. So please stay. Elo omru chachomim im'abrim et ha'shonim elo b'mezumonim lo. But please excuse me, said Rabban Gamliel, for having started off that way and asking you to leave, because the din is, I must give you your first lesson. If you've come to learn, the first lesson is that whoever is present must be specified, they must be invited, and they must be appointed for the job. Then the Gemara says, "V'lo Shmuel Akotin Hodo." And as a matter of fact, it wasn't Shmuel Akotin who was there without invitation. Shmuel Akotin had invitation. Elohim Shachrina, it was one of the other 8. Umachmas Kisufa Hu Do'ovat. And he did it so as to avoid embarrassment to the one who really was there without invitation. Kihodi Yosef Rebbe v'kodorish. It's very similar to the case where Rebbe, one Motzei Shabbos, was giving a shir. Ve'riach reach shum. And he smelt the smell of garlic. Omar mi she'ochal shum yotzo. Yetze. He said, who's ever been eating garlic should please get up and go. It's very rude to come to a gathering of people in a hot, stuffy room when you've been eating garlic, or when you haven't bathed recently, or when you don't use deodorant. That's just not derech eretz. So, Rebbe said, whoever it is that's causing the stink here, please, get up. Amar Rabbi Chiya v'yotzu. Rabbi Chiya got up and he walked out. Amdu kulon v'yotzu. So everybody got up and walked out. I saw that Rabbi Chiya got up, all the Talmidim got up, and they walked out too. It's interesting. Rebbe did right by saying what he said. People have to know that's not the way to behave. You don't come into a gathering of people, and if people have to be taught Derech Eretz the hard way, then they have to be taught Derech Eretz the hard way. A man who's insensitive, you can't teach delicately, because he doesn't take the hint. And a man who comes into a gathering with having eaten garlic is a man who is insensitive. And such a man, you can't just give a shiur on the topic generally of eating garlic, because he won't get the message. There's only one way to deal with such a guy, and that's to say, whoever it is, please get out. And Rabbi Chiya did correctly too. He got up and he went out to avoid embarrassment. He got upset at the possibility that there should be somebody there who would have to get up and walk out. And everybody else who got out after Rabbi Chiya also did correctly, and that's exactly what Rabbi Chiya wanted. So the shiur had to end. There was no other way to handle it. It was exactly right. That's exactly how it had to be, but it couldn't have been done any other way. If Rebbe would just have said, sorry, I refuse to continue the shiur, someone's been eating garlic, that wouldn't have been right. Had he said it and Rabbi Chiya wouldn't have got up, that wouldn't have been right. This is the way it had to go. It's a bit of a charade, but that's the way it had to go. B'shachar matu Rabbi Shimon b'Rebbe l'Rebbe. The next morning, Rabbi Shimon b'Rebbe, the son of Rebbe, Rabbi Shimon, found Rabbi Chiya. Omalei, and he said to him, Matohu shitziyata l'Abba, are you the man who had the chutzpah to cause pain and suffering to my father last night? Were you the one who came to the shiur having eaten garlic? Omar Loi, he said to him, Rabbi Chiya answered, Loi tehe kazois b'Yisrael. Chas v'sholem. Don't let it enter the mind of any Jew that such a thing would have happened. Chas v'sholem, it wasn't me. So the Gemara of Rabbi Chiya meheche gomilo. And where did Rabbi Chiya learn that that was the correct way to behave? Answers the Gemara, mi Rabbi Meir. The Tanya, because we learned in a braisa, maise be'isho acha shebosa lebes midroshu sh'Rabbi Meir. A woman came to the door of the Beis HaMedrash, and we're in the middle of a shiur such as ours, and there's a bang at the door, and a woman walks in, barges in, Omra Loim, she says, Rebbe, who's the head here? Rabbi Meir, Echad mikem kideshoni bevia. There's somebody in this Beis HaMedrash who's married me, and married me not with a ring, and married me not with a shtar, but married me with bia. We've had relations, and then we set up a shack together. Now, I'm not quite sure who it was over here. It's one of your young men. Omad, Rabbi Meir, the Kosav Lord, get Chris. So without saying another word, Rabbi Meir took out his pen and his quill and a piece of parchment, and he wrote her a get. Gave it to her. V'nosan lo, omdu kosvu kulam. So every Talmud in the Beis HaMedrash got up. And they each gave her a gift. So she walked out there with a few hundred gittin under her arm, and that was the end of the story. Asked the Gemara, Rabbi Meir meheche gomilo. And where did Rabbi Meir learn that this is the correct thing to do? Mishmuel HaKotn. He learned from the case of Shmuel HaKotn. Shmuel, which was an early, I think, chronologically, although it was brought first in the Gemara, it was brought first because that's the subject that the Gemara is discussing. But chronologically, Shmuel HaKotn was the first one, and that's where he learned it from. Ushmuel HaKotn meheche gomilo. And where did Shmuel HaKotn learn that that's the right way to behave? That when somebody is accused of something, you should admit to it yourself, even though you're innocent, so as to avoid him embarrassment? Mishchanya ben Yechiel. Bichtiv ayan Shchanya ben Yechiel mibnei ilim v'yom ele ezra. Anachnu ma'alnu be'elokeinu v'noishav noshin nochriyus me'amei horet. Ba'ato yish mikve l'Yisrael. Alvzois. Shchanya ben Yechiel comes to Ezra and he says, we have made a terrible mistake and we've married non-Jewish wives, etc., etc. Shchanya ben Yechiel himself didn't do it, but he came as a spokesman and he didn't say they have married non-Jewish wives. He said, we have married non-Jewish wives. And that's where Shmuel HaKotn learnt it from, that one has to do this. Ask the Gemara, Shchanya ben Yechiel meheche gomelo? And where did Shchanya ben Yechiel? Look how far we're going back now. This is already in Tanakh. This is in Ezra. And the Gemara still wants to know, and where did he learn from that you have to do this? Yoshua. He learned it from Yoshua. Still earlier. Dichtiv vayomer Hashem el Yoshua kum lech. Lama zeo ato noifel al panecho. Choto Yisrael. God said to Yoshua, Yoshua fell on his face and davened and prayed to God after he heard that Achan had taken from the spoil of Yericho. And that had to be set aside as a cherem. It wasn't permitted to be touched by anybody. And Achan went to touch it, and there was a big torus as a result of that. So Yeshua starts davening to the Ribbono Shel Olam, says, God to Yeshua, what are you falling on your face for? Just get up and do something about it. Choto Yisrael, Israel has sinned. Omar Lefonov, Yeshua said to God, Ribbono Shel Olam, mi choto, who is it that did it? That's all. Just tell me who it is, and I'll fix it. Omar Lovachi, dil tarani. What do you think? I'm a tattletale, says God to Yeshua. You're asking me who did it? Go and throw lots and find out who did it. Not for me to tell you who did it. But you see that God says, although only one member of Yisrael sinned, God says, Chata Yisrael, the Jewish people have sinned. And if you want to, you can say the source of this din comes from Moshe. The first Shabbos after the month started coming, when the Jews, or some of the Jews, only a few Jews, went out to collect the month, God starts screaming at Moshe and Aaron, and he says, Ad ano me'antem, how long are you going to persist in ignoring my instructions and my laws and so on, me'antem, you all. He talks in the second person plural. And the Gemara says from there, it wasn't them, it wasn't Moshe, it wasn't Aaron, it wasn't the whole people of Israel. It was a few individuals went and fetched Mon. What is the Rebbeinu telling to the leaders of the people and accusing them and the entire nation of ignoring the words of the Rebbeinu Shlom? Ad ano me'antem, how long will you go and ignoring my words? You see from there also that everybody's responsible. The Gemara is peculiar. The particular peculiarity with which we'll deal is, why is it necessary, why is the Gemara so perturbed with where did they learn this law from? It's a nice thing to do, but you have to have a source for it. It's a nice thing. A Rebbe gets up and he says, who's been eating garlic? And somebody who didn't says it was me. And so he avoids embarrassment. Do you have to have a pasuk to learn that from? Does there have to be a line in Shulchan Aruch that says that's the correct way to behave? Surely it's just svara, surely common decency teaches you that that's a very fine thing to do, that it's a very nice thing to do. And how far the Gemara goes to try and find out where did they learn it from? And he learned it from Rabbi Meir. And where did Rabbi Meir learn it from? He learned it from Shmuel HaKotten. Where did Shmuel HaKotten learn it from? He learned it from Shchanya ben Yechiel. And where did Shchanya ben Yechiel learn it from? He learned it from Yeshua. And Yeshua from Moshe, and so on. So far. But it's not such a simple din at all. First, it's a lie. It's one permitted to get up and tell a lie. The Rebbe says, who's been eating garlic? You say, I have. It's a lie, it's a sheker. So you're doing it to save somebody else embarrassment. Are you permitted under all circumstances to tell lies to save somebody else embarrassment? Number one. Number two, it's arrogance. Who are you to think that you can just take the blame of others? You're a Yoshka. You can manage everybody else's guilt on your shoulders, okay? Who do you think you are? You've got enough of your own avarice. Why can you still take other people's avarice? It's you that's arrogant. And thirdly, why did the Rebbe do this? Why did Rebbe make such a fuss? Just because the smell was bothering him? Because he wanted to teach something. He wanted to teach a bit of Musa. He wanted to educate the guilty culprit and teach him how to be a mensch. So the whole purpose is defeated. By Rabbi Chia getting up and walking out, he doesn't give the Talmud a chance to say sorry. He doesn't give Rebbe a chance to educate the Talmud. He diverts the whole thing. Spoils the whole plot. And so in the case of Rabban Gamliel, it's even worse. That means it landed up that there was still somebody uninvited there. Shmuel HaKotten offered to go out. Rabban Gamliel says, no, what? You can stay as a Talmud. But that means there is somebody uninvited over there. It's not so simple that you're allowed to do this kind of thing. Who says you're allowed to go and put yourself in the position of doing wrong? There's also the Indian of making yourself seem like a chote. There's Chilul Hashem. People look up, Shmuel HaKotten. How could he have done such a thing? It weakens people's respect, not just for the individual, but for the wrongdoing, for the concept of the Avera, Shmuel HaKotten, and Rabbi Chia, and these cases that we've had. How can one do such a thing? So it's not so simple that this is just so moral and so straight and so decent to do. On the surface, our immediate response is, yes, what a menschliche thing to do, what a lovely thing to do. But when you start examining it more carefully, halachically, one begins to understand that it's not so simple that that's the right thing to do. And one then begins to understand why the Gemara gets so perturbed and says, where did they learn from that you're allowed to do this? And they trace it back and back and back and back until they come to Moshe. But that leaves us with a very difficult question. That means that the Gemara requires a source and an authority to permit a human being to act in this way. Without authority, you wouldn't be permitted to do that, to take the blame for somebody else's avodah. It's only because there's authority in the Torah, there's halachic authority. That means, using your own logic, you wouldn't reach that conclusion. Using your own logic, you would conclude that you're not permitted to take the blame. So why does the Torah allow you to do it? What is the yesod? What is the principle which the Torah is in fact teaching? Logically, you're not allowed to take the blame. But there's a possible. Ad anu miyante. Or in the case of Achata Yisrael, in the case of Yeshua, whichever posuk you want to use. But we have psukim in Tanakh to say you may do it. But what's the logic behind it? Why may you do it? We started off saying, well, obviously you can do it. Why do you need psukim? We answered that and said, no, you need psukim because it's not so obvious you can do it at all. On the contrary, when you examine more carefully, it would appear that you may not do this. And now we're going a step further and saying, if it's so clear that you may not do this, what are the psukim really teaching you? Why does it change? Why are you in fact allowed to do it? The effect of environmental influence on an individual is enormous. We're told in the Mishnah already, Harchek mishachenra, mechavera, keep away from bad neighbors and from bad friends, choose your friends carefully. Oy l'rosho, oy l'shcheno, we're told. Woe is the wicked man and woe is to his neighbor. Rebellia used to say, just to tell a story about when he was a child, he was in Lomji, he was in Yeshiva, and they couldn't figure out what happened. You must remember, when Rebellia was a child, we're talking about the turn of the century. Earlier. Before the turn of the century. And they had a little old hospital in Lomji. And they couldn't figure out, people used to come out of the hospital sicker than they went in. The man had something wrong, used to go to hospital and he used to get diseases there that he'd never had before. And so it was going, whoever went into the hospital used to get new and unheard of diseases, and they were curing the old diseases and they were getting the new diseases. It sounds a little bit like what happens today, but then it was unusual. And eventually they examined, and a professor came from Western Europe and he said, no, very simple, this is an old wooden building that hadn't been changed or renovated for many, many years. And he explained to them that the building can get ill too, the building can carry infection. And I thought this was an incredible idea at that time, that the building could actually carry infection, and the building could infect the person. And the building could catch the sickness from the sick person from years ago, and be holding it there, and now somebody else gets it, and because it's not clean and all the rest of it, another person can get the sickness which is being transmitted by the building. Gave them all sorts of understanding into the whole parasha of negoim, of houses, as we've got in the Torah, spiritually, that homes can be spiritually infectious, just buildings, houses. But more than that, Rebellia said that he learned from that the power of an environment. If it applies physically that you can catch disease from a building, never mind from a sick human being. From a sick human being, of other you've got to keep your distance. But even from a sick building, you've got to keep your distance. How much more so spiritually? If you're living in a sick neighborhood, if you're living in a place where everybody's peculiar, where everybody's sick, where everybody's wicked, spiritually sick, morally sick, how infectious that must be to the human being. And at least the body is given certain basic resistance, given an ability to drive off infection. It's given an ability to survive, to fight for survival. But the neshama has none of this. The neshama is wide open to infection, and it has a very low resistance. In fact, it has no resistance. Unless you're going to work on it and work on it, and through exercise and exercise, the basic neshama has no resistance to infection. And right through Torah, this is something we've done very often in these shiurim and generally, is to make comparisons between the physical world and the spiritual world, because God wants us to learn how the spiritual world operates by observing the physical world. And we must understand the spread of spiritual disease exactly the same way as one understands the spread of physical disease. And just as a person can transmit it, and a building can transmit it, and an object which is not clean can transmit it, so it is with spiritual things. Not only can a person transmit it, that's for sure, but an object can transmit it, a building can transmit it, and an environment can transmit it. And therefore there are things where there are no real isurim, but still Chazal are very careful. Don't daven in a shul of amaratzim, we're told. And unless one is an amaoris oneself, then it doesn't matter. But don't daven in a shul where you're surrounded with amaratzim. It doesn't do you any good. It's infectious. Amaratzim is infectious. One catches it. It's a disease which one catches. At least it weakens one's resistance to amaratzim in the future. See that you're davening in a place that is serious. In a place where the people are busy trying to grow. In a place where the busy people are busy trying to develop. a place where the people are busy trying to achieve higher standards today than they had yesterday, to work on themselves, to become more refined, to become more special, to become more sensitive. Live and operate and dive in an atmosphere where that's what you're exposing yourself to. Because if you don't have that, you have no assistance from your environment, and chas v'sholom, if you're in an environment where there's a negative attitude to growth, and a mocking and belittling of that attitude, then chas v'sholom, you actually get infected with a disease, and you start belittling it too. Be careful what neighborhood one lives in, and be careful what town one lives in, and be careful altogether. Just one has to be terribly careful of environment. An environment is infectious, and one can catch disease from one's environment. But it's not only from one's environment and from society in general. The Gemara says in Megillah Daf Kaf Ches, Shor Rebbe is Rabbi Yeshua ben Kochet, the same Rebbe that we just learnt about was giving the garlic shear, asked Rabbi Yeshua ben Kochet, Bameh Rachta Yomim. Rabbi Yeshua ben Kochet was a very, very old man. And in his old age, Rebbe came to him and said, what is the secret of your longevity? What have you done? Obviously there's something you've been doing right, otherwise you wouldn't have made it till now. What is the secret so that we can also do it? Omele cuts to the chayai, says, oh, you're joking, you're mocking me. Rebbe, what do you have to come and learn from me? You're mocking me. Omele, no, Rebbe, Torah here, v'lil moida nitzorich. No, I'm not mocking. This is Torah and I need to understand it. It's an incredible statement. Torah here, this is Torah. Not just learning a blood Gemara. This is Torah to understand why another man has made it. What has he been doing right? That's Torah. The Lil Moed, I need Torah and I need to know it. Amalei, he said to him, if you want to know, Miyomai lo nistakalti bidmus odom rosha. I have never looked at a rosha, at a wicked person. I've never looked at him nor at a photograph of him. Not at all. That's how he reached longevity. The power of the impact that infection can be transmitted by a look at a picture, never mind at the real person. And the Marshal says here, Al Pi Kabbalah, that the face expresses what's really going on in the individual. There's in fact the Yeshiva Bocher who died very young and very tragically a long time ago. He left a fascinating diary which they afterwards published. And one of his little entries there is that if people would know how much their faces give away, they would be embarrassed to walk in the street. And it's true. And a person who understands faces, and a person who understands eyes, and a person who understands expressions, what one can see on a face, you could never get in hours and hours of interview. You don't need to know. And says the Ma'ashot, a face projects, it radiates. Tahara, if it comes from a person who is on a level at that particular time of Tahara, of purity, and it actually radiates Tumah when it's the face of a man who's not living the way he should be living. You actually see the Tumah on the face, and it's so true and it's so correct. And it's not just that on this person you see it and on this person you don't. On any given person, at any given moment, you see the changes, and you can see the changes from one day to the next. See, all of one day the face is a face of kedusha, and it's a beautiful face. And the next day, the same person has that dissipated look about him, and the depths of tumor. In one day, it can happen. And you can just say something to him, and one of two things will happen. He'll either say, no, it's not true. Or he'll say, how do you know? And if he says, no, it's not true, when you get in quietly a few weeks later and you say, was it true? He'll say, yes, it was true. It's foolproof, absolutely. What one can tell from the face, one can tell with more accuracy and with more clarity than with any other means of getting to know a human being. No IQ tests, and no psychiatric and psychological tests, and no psychoanalysis, and no handwriting analysis, no what you like. You'll never tell as much about a human being in terms of where he's holding as you can tell by one glance at his face. That's it. And says Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha, I never looked at a Rosha in his face, nor at the Dmus, nor at the picture of a Rosha of a Rosha's face. I was once in a Hasidic community, a very close to the Hasidic community, for a few days. And my first observation there was how beautiful the children looked. I don't know what it was, but those children looked like angels. And they behaved almost like angels. And it was just something unbelievable. Like every single child, I was there with a friend, and I said, look, each single one. Find me one. We were standing in the base of Medrash of hundreds of people. I said, find me one child that doesn't look like an angel, but like a malach, absolutely like an angel. If you find one that looks a little bit like an angel, I want to see him. Because as far as I can see, every child looks as if he comes right min ha-shamayim. And we searched and we looked and we looked and we looked, and there wasn't one child that had a blank face or a devilish face, or everyone looked like an angel. Alert, bright, kind, open, warm. Every child. Eventually I got hold of some of the leaders of the community and I said, how do you do it? Every single child, not one. They said, do you realize these children have never seen a Mechalel Shabbos in their lives? They've never seen a Jew not observing Shabbos. They've never heard of a Jew not eating kosher. They haven't heard a word of Lashon Hara. Not one. It doesn't happen. Not in front of the children. Anyway, that the parents know. And there's not a car that comes into this place on Shabbos. And there's not a piece of trace food that comes into this place. I haven't even seen a newspaper. We don't allow newspapers in here. Because of the pictures and the articles and all that. You want to see a newspaper, you go out of our town. Not in our town, there won't be a newspaper. And these people said to you, you might think that that's very narrow and all the rest of it, but look what we've produced. And I said to them, I did think it was very narrow until today. For the first time I understand the real ghetto mentality. But for a real ghetto mentality to work, there has to be Kedusha inside the ghetto. It doesn't help keeping out the people who drive in Shabbos, and inside you've got the people who Mechalel Shem Shamayim, and the people who talk Lashon Hora, and all the rest of it. If the people who inside are keeping a level of Kedusha, and you don't let your children outside, one sees what there is, and one saw Bechush, the effect. And a few days later I said to him, but what's happened to the adults? Why are the adults not stay looking like angels? They answered correctly, the adults have been out. That's what it is. There's no adult here who's lived here all his life. Each one has been out, each one has had something to do with the world. And it suddenly struck me, is it possible that that's true? Is it possible that that is a unique sociological experiment of the effect of an environment? To the extent that one can look at every single child and not find one that looks like anything but a malach, and look at every single adult and not find one that does look like a malach. And the only difference between the adults and the children is that the adults have been out and the children haven't. And one sees from the Gemara that that is possible. But Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha ascribes his longevity to the fact that he's never seen a Rosha. He doesn't know what he looks like. He's never looked at one. That's the power and the infectiousness of an environment. And don't think that a Rosha means a Hitler, although it means him too. And don't think that a Rosha means an Amalek, although it means him too. A Rosha means anybody who is not working on himself to develop refinement and menschlichkeit and kedusha and higher levels of spiritual achievement. That's a Rosha. And that's the kind of guy that Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha would never look at. Just an ordinary guy who doesn't take things terribly seriously, a happy-go-lucky yid. That even that kind of guy Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha wouldn't look at. The only people he looked at were people who were busy working on themselves, improving themselves, raising themselves. That's the power of environment. And if that's the power of negative environment, what's the power of looking at a tzaddik? If looking at a rosha can be so distractive, what is it to look at a tzaddik? How great, how wonderful must be the effect on an individual just to look. Never mind to live among tzaddikim, never mind to do business with tzaddikim, to have tzaddikim in your home, entertain them, have them at your table, have your children growing up in their presence, never mind all that, just to look. Imagine the effect it must have. Incredible. What it must be. There's no question that if I look back at my childhood, some of the most potent moments were moments of close contact with Gedolei Yisrael. Sitting on their knees, listening to the crosstalk. And I was never told to go out of the room when the Gadol B'Yisrael was there, since I was a little tiny tot. Not only wasn't I told to go out of the room, I was called into the room. No matter how sophisticated the discussion, my father might have been talking to them about some machlokes we shown him in a mesechta that I didn't know existed. Made no difference. I sat there. And those are the moments that stick in my life, in my mind. And those are the things that must have influenced me more than any education. No school, no teacher, no nothing could have given the kind of influence that that did. And later on, in Eretz Yisrael, coming into contact with these people, learning under them, seeing them, operate with them, and not just with the gedolim in terms of the teachers, but even with the people who you sit with on the bench. Just the people who are sitting next to you. Sometimes unbelievable tzaddikim. Unbelievable tzaddikim. And when I chose yeshivas, I chose for two things. The person whose shir I was going to listen to, I wasn't interested in any of the other Magideh shir, I wasn't interested in the Rosh Yeshiva, I was interested in the person whose shir I was going to listen to, and I was interested in the people with whom I would be sharing a room, and who I'd be sitting next to on the bench. That's all I was interested in. If I could find a great person to learn under, and tzaddikim to sit with, then I knew it was okay. And that's how I operated. And that was the greatest influence that there could possibly have been during my entire yeshiva education. One sees that must be so. The effect of seeing the tzaddikim, even of seeing those little children that I told you about, the image is clear in my mind. Those little faces, the faces of little angels, the faces of tzara, the faces of unspoiled, untouched purity, are faces one has to see. Just to get one's perspective and one's standard right. One becomes desensitized, one sees so much of it. Ugliness and filth and tumor over and over. One just sees it all the time. One becomes totally desensitized to it. To the extent that when one sees something beautiful, and when one sees something special, and one sees something perfect, one finds it difficult to even relate to it. So hardened is one to what one's used to seeing. What the Gemara in the Sanhedrin comes to teach us is not that you're permitted to take responsibility for somebody else's misdeed. You're not. You can't take responsibility for somebody else's misdeed. What it comes to teach us is that it's not their misdeed. When Shmuel HaKotan got up and he said it was me, he wasn't playing the fool or telling a lie. What he was saying is that if I was who I should be, nobody else would have had the chutzpah to do that. Nobody should have had the chutzpah in the presence of Shmuel HaKotan to sneak into a room uninvited. It means they're not scared of me. It means they don't feel me. It means I'm not potent enough. It means I'm having no effect. So it's my fault, Rabban Gamliel. I'm the one who needs to be thrown out. Because if I was as I should have been, nobody would have been here. And I'm part of the Avera. I'm part of the mistake. And so it is with Rabbi Chia. And Rabbi Chia says to Rebbe that he's the one who ate the garlic. Of course he wasn't the one who ate the garlic. And of course Rebbe knew that Rabbi Chia would never have done it. And of course everybody else knew it wasn't Rabbi Chia. That's why they all walked out together with Rabbi Chia. So not to embarrass the person who really did it. But what Rabbi Chia is saying again is not I ate the garlic. That would be stupid to say such a thing. What he's saying is I am responsible for the fact that somebody else could have had the chutzpah to eat the garlic in my presence. That's the chiddush of the Telzer Rav. The Telzer Rav explains the Gemara that way. That the chiddush of the Gemara is not that you may take responsibility for somebody else's misdeeds, but you are responsible for their misdeeds. Because if you were who you should have been, those misdeeds would never have occurred. And that just changes the whole outlook to the concept of Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh B'Zeh. That all Jews are responsible for one another. We were discussing it in the ladies' shiur this morning a little bit. We're talking about how difficult it is. You're responsible. You see somebody else on Shabbos take out a match and light their cigarette. Oh, you think a chiyuv skila. So you go and you say, you know, you shouldn't do that on Shabbos. What do they think of you? Doesn't help. Doesn't encourage peaceful relationships between people, nor does it stop them smoking the cigarette. So what have you achieved? So how are you mekayim the principle of taking responsibility for other people? According to this principle of the Gemara in Sanhedrin, it becomes very clear. If you are who you should be, as you walk down the road, nobody would light their cigarettes. They would at least wait until you've passed. At least that. And if they can do it in front of you, that means they sense that you don't care enough about it. That it's not even an affront to you. That it's not even an insult to you. If Shmuel HaKotan was who he should have been, the uninvited guest wouldn't have come up. If Rabbi Chia was who he should have been, a person who'd eaten garlic would never have come into the shir. If Yeshua was who he should have been. Achan would never have done what he did. And the same with Moshe and Aaron, and the same with all the other cases. That's the principle of Kol Yisrael Arevim Zebozeh. That your stature is what affects others because of the tremendous influence. If just that looking at a Rosho can damage you, and just looking at a tzaddik can elevate you, how responsible are we to one another for not being tzaddiki? Just imagine. If I said to myself, if only I was a tzaddik, everybody in this room could go out of the room tonight, elevated, even if they didn't understand a word I was saying. They just looked at me. And I would think to myself, how elevated? And I would think of Rabbi Yeshua ben Koch. He didn't look at it, Rosh, not even once. Why not once? Because even once would have destroyed him. That would mean, contrary-wise, that looking at a tzaddik even once could make you, could build you. And I would say to myself, my goodness, if only I was a tzaddik, everybody in this room could have been much, much greater, Erev Rosh Hashanah, what it could have done for them. It's my responsibility for not being the tzaddik that I could be, what you losing out. That's the feeling of Kol Yisrael Arev in Zemudim. Not that I didn't give you enough musr and I didn't scream at you enough, and if I screamed a little bit louder, a little bit harder, maybe you would be a little bit gooder. No! If I would have been a little bit greater, so would you have been because of the contact you had with me. That's the principle of Kol Yisrael Arev in Zemudim. And it doesn't only apply to me, it applies to every one of you. That each one of you should feel how greater and how much closer to God anybody could be through coming into contact with you, if you were greater yourself. That's Kol Yisrael Arev in Zemudim. And that I call the social side of Arevus, the social side of mutual responsibility. Because that's not only among Jews, that's universal. We could change the whole world if only we were different. One individual could change the world. I told you last week at the Shalosh Shudos about Naftali Amsterdam, who had made an undertaking upon himself to bring all of Klal Yisrael back to Tshuva. And when they asked him how he planned to do it, he said, by just being myself, a living example of what Shulchan Aruch is supposed to be. So that people, by looking at me, would be inspired to do right, and would be inspired to come back to Yiddishkeit. That's the kind of thing that we're supposed to be aiming at, and that's the kind of thing we're supposed to be achieving. Once one can begin to feel this, but it needs working on, this is not the kind of thing that can go in one ear and out the other ear and have any kind of use whatever. And I must say that the case is the same about all these Motzei Shabbos shiurim. To listen to them is just not good enough. To understand them is also not good enough. And to revise them is also not good enough. Now, there are not that many people who listen to them. There are still fewer who understand them. There are hardly any who revise them, and I'm still saying that that's still not good enough. They have to be practiced, and by practice I don't mean done. I mean practice like you practice scales, over and over and over and over again, until it becomes part of your nature. And at least for the week between one Motzei Shabbos shiur and another, it needs to be practiced. One needs to remind oneself constantly, 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 of one's arevus, of one's responsibility to be a mensch, because if I would be special, contact with me could make so many other people special too, and that could change the world. It's not going to change the world by going and making people frum and doing this and doing that. It's good and it's nice and it's fantastic, but it doesn't change their status. That doesn't make them mention. That doesn't make them fine. That doesn't make them godly. So you've taught them now. They're putting on tefillin and they dress the right way and they're in black and they've got beard and they look very good and they play the part. Is that bringing them closer to God? Because now they put on tefillin. Because now they keep Shabbos. That's not going to do it. What's going to do it is they've got to see in you, a frum person, what spirituality and what refinement is. And through a contact with you, they've got to become closer and closer and closer. Not to ritualistic Judaism only, but to spirituality, to refinement, to kedusha, to tahara. And how can you do that if you don't have it yourself? My only argument with the particular Lubavitchers all over the world who do go out on putting on tefillin and so on, is not that it's a bad thing to do. But be careful who does it. Because the great thing, the effect is going to be not by making him put on the tefillin, but by the relationship that those two people establish. If the man who comes has never put on the tefillin is accosted by a big guy who starts bullying him into putting on tefillin, and he puts on tefillin, you haven't achieved anything. A bit of resentment, that's all you've achieved. But if the man who gets him to put on tefillin is a finer mensch, and he's dressed nicely, and he presents himself nicely, and he speaks nicely, And when he's finished putting on the tefillin, he invites the guy home, and they talk, and so a relationship is established. Then, yes, then you have a chance of changing the world. But not just by going through the action. It has to be done properly, and it has to be done with this principle in mind. The principle of arevus. The principle that if I'm as fine as I should be, just by other people seeing me, I'm going to be makariv them. And I'm going to be makariv them, I'm going to bring them near, not to formalistic Yiddishkeit, but I'm going to bring them near to God and to godliness. That's arevus. Social arevus. When one begins to feel that, one can begin to understand the Kabbalistic concept, which goes a little bit further and is particularly unique to the Jews. I can just find the pasuk on which it's based. In Bereishit chapter 46 verse 26, Kol ha-nefesh ha-bo li-Yaakov Mitzrayimah, all the soul that came with Yaakov to Egypt, Yotzei Yerecho, we were born through him, Milvad Meshev and Yaakov, excepting for the wives of the sons of Yaakov, Kol Nefesh, but all the Nefesh was Shishim Beshe, 66. As I'll say, why is Nefesh in the singular? Nefesh, all the souls, that should say, not all the soul was 66. And it's from here, and on this pasuk, that the Kabbalistic principle is based, that the whole of Klal Yisrael have one Neshoma. They're all part of one Neshoma, different parts of the same Neshoma. And that's the next level in the understanding of the principle of arevus, in the understanding of the principle of responsibility. And this is now not social responsibility, this is metaphysical responsibility. This is, you can't hit somebody with your hand, and then the guy says, what have you done? He said, I did nothing, it was my hand. Hit it if you want to. Cut it off, do what you want. It was my hand, it wasn't me. You wouldn't think of such a thing, it would be absurd, it would be ridiculous. So for one Jew to see another Jew's actions as not part of his own is equally absurd. We're part of one neshama, we're part of one nefesh, we're all the same thing. We're different limbs of the same body, and it's one body. One needs to understand that, and one needs to feel that. But that's too difficult to feel in one go. One has to go through the steps that I've described. First, to understand that you are socially responsible just by virtue of the influence that you have, whether you like it or not. Everybody is influential. Everybody is powerful. Everybody has it within them to change every human being into whose contact they come. And everybody is either making such opportunities and using them, or losing such opportunities at every moment, depending on how you're relating to people and who you are yourself. When you understand that, your social responsibility in a universal sense, that's not only Jewish, that's universal, that's between you and everybody. When you've understood that, then it's easier to take the next jump into the Kabbalistic metaphysical field of understanding that in fact we are responsible one for another, because we are all part of the same body. That's arevus. One needs to understand the extent of the arevus, and one needs to understand the working of the arevus. The main beauty of this concept is that it resolves totally the conflict which psychologists, sociologists, moralists have been battling with for generations and will never ever find a solution to. And that's the conflict between selfishness and selflessness. If you're going to be selfless, you'll never get anywhere. You're always helping everybody else. So when are you going to study? When are you going to learn? When are you going to progress? You're a big mitzvah guy. Doesn't help being a big mitzvah guy. The biggest mitzvah is to see that you yourself are somebody worthy of it all. And yet, if you're going to be a selfish egoist, always worried about your own growth and own development, what kind of a mensch can you be? And Hillel started grappling with it when he said, "In Eina Nili Nili, if I'm not going to motivate my own growth and work for my own growth, Nili, who can I expect to do it? I can't expect anybody else to make me great. If I'm going to become great, I'm going to do it myself. Vimanili, ask me. And if that's all I do, Mani, what am I?" Okay, so you say, "Hello, thank you very much, it's very profound. But what do you do about it?" The fact is, every moment I'm working on myself, I'm sacrificing chesed, I could be working on others. And every moment I could be working on others, I'm sacrificing my own progress.
And there's a constant conflict which is unresolved between these two things. And man finds himself continuously, a moral man, a man who at least is on the level where he's worrying about such things, finds himself continually torn between his responsibility to community and his responsibility to himself. Responsibility to family and to himself. His responsibility to other families and to his own family. This really answers it. As the Shimon Scott says in his introduction to Sara Yosha, the spiritual status of a man is measured by the magnitude of his ego. It sounds a funny thing for the Shimon Scott to say. The bigger his ego, the greater he is. The smaller his ego, the smaller he is. What do we mean? Ask a man, who are you? Or ask yourself, who are you? If you see yourself as that image of when you look in the mirror, that's me. That's the sum total of your ego. It's 5'9" tall or 5'11" tall, and it's so and so many centimeters wide, and it's so and so many years old, and it lives in such and such a place. That's my ego. That's a very tiny ego, very, very small. You have a bigger man who realizes that what he sees in the mirror is only part of him. He has a neshama, he has an intellect also, he has feelings, he has emotion. It's not just the physical him, it's the spiritual and the emotional him as well, which forms part of his essence.
Says Reb Shimon, that's already getting a bit bigger there. Then you've got a man who says, who are you? I'm not just me. My family is me too. My wife, my children, that's part of me. You hurt them, you're hurting me. You do good for them, you do good, you're doing good for me. There's no difference between them and me. The ego is beginning to get a little bit bigger. It's not just me in the personal sense. It's now a bigger me. When I talk about I, it's not just I, but it's we. And then you have a man whose ego is not just his family, but it's his expanded family. It's his community. It's his chevra. And then you have a man who's the whole of Klal Yisrael. Every Jew, when you talk about me, that's us, Jews. We're all one. And you know, that's not so difficult to understand, and Kabbalistically it is there. It's there not only among Jews, but it's there even universally. When a man acts heroically, let's say for example, Chas v'Sholom, your child is the case that we had, Nebuch, down the road. A woman flies into a burning car to save a child. Nebuch, not successfully, but let's not worry about whether it was successful or not. What levels of heroism is it to run into a burning car to save a child? Not heroism at all. It's natural. It's normal. There would be something terribly sick about a parent who didn't do that. Why? It's me in the car. It's just a further part of me. It's like my arm is burning. So you say, leave your arm, come, leave it. Can't leave it, pull it out. My child is part of me. One begins to see the bigger ego. It's all part of me. I can't leave a part of me in a burning vehicle. And if it's not one's child, if it's another human being, also people will go to tremendous acts of heroism to try and save somebody else. At times of war, the stories one reads, particularly the stories of heroism during the Israeli wars, are unheard of among other nations. They read like legends. And they were done by ordinary grub people. They weren't done by the tzaddikim only. They were done by the real hardened coarse soldiers that formed the basis of the attacking lines. These are the people that they trained in the most vicious, cruel ways to be vicious and cruel. And yet when it came to saving a buddy, they gave their lives. What they didn't only do. The army was approaching a barbed wire fence. There wasn't a moment's thought the people that got to the barbed wire fence first threw themselves over the fence, but everybody else could walk over them. They knew they would be killed instantly. There wasn't even a moment's hesitation in taking the Golan Heights. What was it a matter of? You had to build a road up the mountain while they were shooting down at you. So everybody knew that the first driver and his crew would make 5 meters and be killed, and the next one would make another 5 meters, and the next one might make 10 meters, and the last ones are the ones that are going to get there. So you would think that everybody rushes to the back of the queue. No, everybody was rushing to the front of the queue. And these weren't tzaddikim, these weren't Rosh Yeshivas. These were just ordinary Israelis. Because it's all us, it's all one. One's able, particularly among Jews, to feel this Kabbalistic concept of a greater me of a greater I, of a greater ego. We're all one. But it normally only comes to the fore when we're being threatened and when we're being hurt. When we're living our normal lives, there's somehow a barrier, there's an alienation, I don't know what it is. There's a sickness. We become terribly, terribly sick in that we don't feel the relationship between our limbs and ourselves. We're completely disorientated. We're numb. We don't feel. We look at a hand and we don't realize it's ours. Do you know how sick one has to be, Nebuch? You come to a person and you see him cutting his hand. You say, what are you doing? Well, it's not my hand. Cutting away. Nebuch, what you would do, you would take him off to a doctor and you would think there's no hope for him anymore. And that's how it is. The extent to which we become insensitive and to which we ignore the faith of another Jew, even somebody relatively close to us, is sickness beyond imagining. Ill, sick, 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 broken, dead. And that's where we're holding. Where this whole feeling of our ravers just doesn't exist. Not the awareness. I mentioned to you earlier at the Shavuot Shudas that this is going to become a theme for the next year. I don't say it will be a theme in the Matzah Shavuot Shirim, I don't know yet. It will certainly be a practical theme that will have to be worked on and developed and improved. Because a society that doesn't have this has nothing. And what's the point of learning Noch HaTosfos, Noch HaGemora, Noch HaMedrash, Noch HaShtiku Rashi and Chumash if you haven't got this? Well, what's it for? So you'll come to Olam Haba, you'll say to Ribbono Shel Olam, I know it all. Throw you in a garbage can. A monkey who knows it all. Doesn't need that kind of person. Be a mensch and you don't know it all, rather. Know a little bit less. But feel, understand, be sensitive, be sympathetic, operate, work like a healthy human being. You're a healthy human being, you can start learning. But to be completely off. So we're going to work on that a lot, in Shiurim and out of Shiurim. The only comforting word is that, you know, if you're operating, if your whole body is sick, chas v'sholom, your legs are amputated and your arms are amputated and chas v'sholom, you've got cancer all over the place, and your heart is still pumping away, you've got a much stronger heart than an ordinary healthy person's heart is pumping away. That's a major feat and a major accomplishment that you're living and you're operating. If you're living in a society that is so sick, and I don't just talk about our society sitting in this room, I'm talking about our whole society is so terribly sick in this way. Our whole Jewish society also is so terribly lacking and inadequate in this particular area of a feeling of arevus, a feeling of responsibility and understanding that when I'm helping you, it's not detracting from me. I'm helping me, the big me. There are times and there are times. I don't have to play with my children all day, but I have to give them some time. I don't have to sit and have tea with my wife all evening, but I have to give her some time. And so it is. I don't have to do chesed all day and all night and never learn and never progress myself, but I have to do it some of the time. And to understand that that's not contrary to my own progress, and that selfishness and selflessness don't contradict because it's the same self. The lack of the understanding of that principle in our lifestyles is so sick that when you find individuals, and there are many individuals, who overcome that, and who, despite the fact that they're living in an environment of such apathy, and despite the fact that they're living in an environment that is so infectiously ill, are able to maintain their own sanity and their own health, and against all the odds are able to show a little bit of caring and a little bit of thoughtfulness, just are able to stop and think about the other guy. What does he need? What can I do for him? Even if I can do nothing, let me at least tell him that I notice you need something and I'm sorry I can't do anything for you. I wish I could. Just that. A man who's capable at least of that, despite all the odds of living in a sick, apathetic society where one human being looks at the other as if he's looking at a stranger, and yet he's able to achieve just a little bit of the caring we're talking about. How the Ribbono Shel Olam will pay that man off. Not the same as when he's living in a healthy society. Those of us who are able to care, despite those odds, can face Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur with such confidence and with such a feeling of satisfaction, because you can just turn around to the Ribbono Shel Olam and say, look, Ribbono Shel Olam, if everybody was trying to do what I'm trying to do, I would be still greater. But you put me in a sick hospital where I'm being infected and bombarded by these diseases wherever I turn. And yet I've tried and I've been in my own little way successful. The Rebbeinu Shel Olam will pat you on the back and in Yirtzeh Hashem send you off on the next year on a trip which will be successful and fruitful and happy and healthy, and in a way that you're able not only to continue in your own path against the stream, but that someday, sometime, you'll be able to participate in reversing the whole stream, so that when it comes next Rosh Hashanah, you won't have that excuse anymore. That you'll be part of the whole lot, you'll be part of the stream, who are all working to the same ends, the ends of caring, the ends of arevus, the ends of noticing. The bris which is talked about in the beginning of this week's Sedra is exactly that bris, the bris of Arevus. And the Sedra starts off talking in the plural, Atem, you plural, Nitzavim, have been made to stand, plural, Hayom Kulchem, today all of you, Lifnei Hashem Elokeichem, Roshechem, Shifteichem, the heads of your tribes, Ziknechem, Shotreichem, Kol Yish Yisrael, Tapchem, Neshechem, all plural. To make you singular, participate in the covenant of God. And the covenant is Kol Yisrael Arevim Zebazeh, and that's in the singular. When we stand before God on Yom Kippur, we say Ashamnu in the plural, we have sinned, even if you didn't. You did because the guy next to you did, and if you were who you should have been, he wouldn't have sinned. He would never have sinned if you were the kind of guy you should have been. So you jolly well stand and you say also, Ashamnu, we all did it. But when God talks to us, it's no plural. It's La'ov Recha, you're all one. And you're all equally responsible for each other, and for each other's achievements, and for each other's lack of achievements. It all has to be understood and it all has to be felt. And with that, I would like to wish you all a Ksiva V'Chasima Tova, to have a Yom Tov which will be happy, and meaningful, and memorable, successful, and that it will herald in a year of very great happiness and success and health for all of you. I want to thank you for attending the shiur on an evening which I know is not easy, and most of you have attended it very consistently and at great sacrifice, and I know that, and I'm honored by it, and I appreciate it, and I just hope that what you've got out of it has been worth what you've put into it. I can just tell you one thing, that whether it has or it hasn't, you can get even more out of it by putting still more into it. It's just one of those things, as all of Torah is, particularly on the practical level. If you start living it and doing it and making a conscious effort, the effects of it can be felt for a lifetime. But even those of you who've only put in the effort of coming, you know, at the very next Sedra, next week it starts. These Sedras are usually combined, so maybe you should at least just mention something from next week. There's the mitzvah on every seventh, or it's actually the eighth, after the Shemitah year, on Chag HaSukkot, the whole of the people of Israel had to be gathered together at the Beis HaMikdash, and the Melech, the king, used to teach them Torah. Hakel etam, gather the people. Ha'anoshim va'anoshim va'atat, the men, the women, and the little ones. Bear in mind that at that time the women were far less sophisticated and educated than our women today. And the women then, mostly for lack of opportunity, were not really able to follow the intellectual discussions that would be carrying on between the king and the men. There might have been many men also who weren't capable, but they had no excuse for not. The women were busy and they didn't have an opportunity. And Rashi explains what it's all about, all these people that have to come. Ha'anoshim, the men, why do the men come? Yilmadu. The anoshim come to teach. Lilmud. Vahanoshim, and the women, Lilmud, the men come to learn. Vanoshim, they won't be able to learn, they won't understand what's going on. There's a whole discussion going on there, and this one, and that one, and a people going on, and the king is discussing with the Rosh Hashivas, and the Rosh Hashivas is discussing with the Rabbonim, and the Rabbonim are discussing among themselves, and with the Balabatim, but the women, Nebuch, who've been busy all the time making it possible for the men to spend time learning, they won't know what's going on, so what's the point of them even sitting there? Vahanoshim lishmoya, just to hear. That can also have an effect. And the little ones and the babies are bought, brought to give schus to those who brought them. Just that you bring the baby along is also schus. So I say to you, as far as the shir is concerned, that even those who have not put in any effort in practicing it and in revising it, just in yilmudu and sitting here and learning, and those of you who maybe haven't understood them in full, just in hearing them, it's all effort for which you get schus. It's effort which affects you, which has results, and for which you deserve a great deal of merit and a great deal of credit. And I hope that that, together with all the other schuyas, will count in your favor and in the favor of all of us over Yom Tov. Don't forget that over Rosh Hashanah there's very little emphasis on personal, on your personal business. It's all Kol Yisrael Arevi, not only Kol Yisrael, but the whole world. On Rosh Hashanah we daven for each other, we daven for our community, we daven for Jews all over the world, we just daven for non-Jews, we daven for the whole world on Rosh Hashanah. Yom Kippur we get a bit more personal, but Rosh Hashanah the emphasis is on universalism.